Today, a loophole in UK law for antique firearms and untraceable bullets. And The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, on the 200th anniversary of the Peterloo Massacre, an event that would eventually lead to the creation of the Manchester Guardian.
But first. I'm here too.
With India. In the studio.
For the first time ever.
Yeah, very odd.
Very odd because we have to tell listeners some very, very sad news, particularly sad for me, which is that India, you're leaving us.
I am. Yeah. It is sad.
Don't do it. Why?
Well, it's been totally amazing, but I'm going to take a bit of time out. I'm going to travel. And I also just want to spend a bit more time thinking about the climate crisis and some of the environment reporting that we've done here.
You have done some amazing reporting on the climate crisis, as well as lots of other things that would encourage people to go and listen to, because India, you are going to be hugely, hugely missed from Today in Focus, because you've been an absolute inspiration to everyone here. We are now going to take a 2-week break for the summer.
Yep.
I promise you we will be back. So be ready to listen again on September the 2nd, when we won't have India presenting anymore, but we will have another brilliant producer in our team.
Rachel Humphreys.
Who's
amazing. So that's really exciting. And this is our 197th episode. I counted it twice today, but it has been an incredible year. And thank you to everybody who's been listening to us and to the whole team who are just amazing. So keep listening to Today in Focus. I certainly will. I'm going to miss you all.
And listen to today's episode because it's brilliant. We'll be back in September.
Ambo is about half a minute away now, where two ambulances coming.
A drive-by murder outside a nightclub in Birmingham, in the West Midlands of the UK in 2003, was shocking. Video from a police helicopter showed the murder scene. There were bodies strewn on the pavement and stretchers laid out.
Paramedics arrive to find mayhem. Four young girls have been shot, innocents caught by a hail of machine gun fire outside a New Year's party in Aston. Two teenage friends died.
That tragic night, Letitia Shakespeare, aged 17, and Charlene Ellis, aged 18, both died. Innocent victims caught in the crossfire of gang shootings. The violence was horrifying and set off a huge police investigation. But when police examined the scene, they found that one of the guns used was an antique. And as it was an antique, the ammunition fired from it was handmade and also untraceable. These first few bullets found at the scene in 2003 were only the very beginning. The UK has some of the strictest gun laws in the world, but over the past 10 years, gangs have increasingly used antique firearms to get around the law. Hundreds of ghost bullets started to appear in crime scenes across the country, and a long search began for their anonymous creator. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, who is behind Britain's ghost bullets?
First, you have to understand the anatomy of a bullet, right? The bullet is not the full cartridge. The bullet is just the lead projectile that is fired from a bullet and then strikes its victim.
This is Ken Rosen, an American journalist who's fascinated by how British gangs are sourcing custom-made bullets to make obsolete antique guns usable weapons again.
The rest that's left behind, the casings that they're often called, are the second part of the cartridge. And the police found both the lead bullet and the casings at the scene of the crime and were perplexed because these aren't made anymore for this weapon.
So why would you need a replica cartridge? UK gun control laws said, and still indicate, that some people can buy, sell, and possess certain antique firearms without a license, provided they are owned as curiosities or display pieces. Criminals were exploiting this loophole and arming themselves. In this case, the gun at the murder scene was a World War II-era pistol.
I mean, this gun was made in 1944 and is 1944 produced. So that meant that someone was in the UK making these by hand for this specific weapon.
Ken says that the first time these untraceable so-called ghost bullets appeared was in the aftermath of the Birmingham drive-by. The killers used a Mac-10, a semi-automatic rapid-fire gun, a and also the antique gun.
Leon Harris, the third friend, got away and made it out alive, but was shot at with a 9mm 1944 Spanish Llama pistol, which is a very, very old pistol. The MAC-10 is more of a new age gun. But the Spanish pistol is an oddity. It's almost an antique.
And the bullets for a gun like this have to be made to order. They have to be handcrafted, which also means they don't bear a manufacturer's mark, making them totally untraceable.
The MAC-10 rounds that the police later found at the scene were not particularly unusual. They were cut from a cloth or a manufacturer that you would find any other bullets from, and you can find a purchase order and trace the order back to who purchased them. But for the Spanish revolver, the 9mm, there would be no way of finding out who created that. And I think at first it was more of a curiosity. It was not something the police had seen and was perhaps what they believed was a one-off. So it was the first instance, but then there were more.
Someone, somewhere, was manufacturing homemade cartridges and bullets for antique guns. This incident in 2003, this was an isolated case, a troubling but unique occurrence. And for a while after, ghost bullets did go quiet. But 10 years later, antique guns made a reappearance. In 2013, an off-duty British soldier, Fusilier Lee Rigby, was brutally murdered in the street by two men.
It all started on this street in Woolwich in the middle of the afternoon. This car was driven onto the pavement and into the path of a man believed to be a serving soldier. Two men got out of the car and carried out a savage attack.
Although he didn't use it, one of the killers was carrying a 90-year-old, rusty, Dutch 9.4mm revolver. And then a number of other instances using weapons like this started to alert police. Shots fired at police during the Birmingham riots in 2011, and then a 2014 Boxing Day killing outside a London West End club. Detectives started to spot a pattern.
So was it these three instances, or had there been quite a lot in between?
Most importantly, a lot of the weapons and ammunition were being traced back to one gang in particular, and that was the Burger Bar Boys.
Diligent on that M. They don't step. Diligent. Big corn in this thing. Click like everybody dead.
This is them. Diligent. Named after their favourite hangout. The Burger Bar Boys have run their violent drugs business around Birmingham's notorious Soho Road since the 1990s. Their rivals, the Johnson Crew, operated in a similar territory, their turf split by a postcode. Revenge shootings and violence were commonplace. But why were they using antique weapons?
And during their investigation, the police are also finding that criminals are carrying these antique weapons, and they know that if they get stopped or searched, that if they are found with an antique weapon, they say, oh, no, you know, I might be taking this to my mantle to put it on for display. You know, it's not illegal per the Home Office regulations. And they found a loophole that allows them to operate sort of autonomously from the laws that everyone else follows.
The more relaxed law around vintage guns is there to protect the interests of hobbyists and collectors. The assumption is that these weapons do not have ammo and are never fired. So it was the bullets that the police needed to trace.
Every shooting that the Burger Bar Boys were involved with, there were more of these strange, handmade, bespoke cartridges, both the cartridges themselves, the casing, and the lead rounds.
As the violence went on, the police were increasingly confused. What sort of criminal was assisting the conversion of museum pieces into deadly weapons?
See, that's the thing, right? They're looking for a criminal, an armorer within a gang, someone who is well endowed financially and with the skill set to create these bullets. So they're trying to go down the normal paths of who have we arrested before? Who do we know are linked to the Burger Bar gang? Who might be the guy who provides their arsenal?
What skills do you need to make antique ammunition?
Know the properties of the gunpowder you're using in relation to the spark or the ignition cap that you're also putting on the cartridge. Another thing you would need is dexterity. It takes precision and skill to seat it just right. So it's really more of a machinist who can do it. But even still, you would need sort of a cookbook that tells you how much gunpowder per round per ignition cap. It'd be sort of like a mad scientist in a way.
So At this point, the police have built up a profile of an antique gun specialist of the Birmingham criminal underworld. They associate with gangs. They're highly skilled, well-connected.
The summer of 2014, the police launched an investigation, codenamed Operation Cookie, into the Burger Bar Boys and the Johnson Crew.
The first thing that happens is the police figure out who the chief armourer of the Burger Bar Boys is. It's a man called Sundish Nasran. He's amassed dozens of antique weapons at his base in Birmingham.
So he was later charged with supplying these weapons to the Burger Bar Boys for use in these drive-by shootings and the other inner gang warfare.
The police thought they'd found the main pipeline of guns to the Burger Bar Boys. But then they came across something that perplexed them in some of Nasran's WhatsApp conversations.
There are a lot of words about watches and batteries and as if two horologists were talking with each other. But of course, he wasn't selling any watch parts.
They figured out that watches was actually a code word for guns and batteries was code for bullets. They traced the number Nasran had been messaging to a man called Mahinder Sardar.
He was a physiotherapist, was once the chief physiotherapist of the Great Britain Olympic karate team. He had a registered, he was a firearm certificate holder. He could legally possess firearms that were listed on his certificate. He oftentimes posed on Instagram and Facebook with pictures of his weapons, which wasn't necessarily illegal. Again, he was legally allowed to possess those weapons. And what he did on his free time, he could brandish them how he pleased.
So he suddenly gets connected to Sundish Nasran, who's been dealing antique firearms to the Burger Bar Boys gang in Birmingham, but he was a physiotherapist for the GB karate team.
That's right. And the police weren't sure how they were linked until they started reading the messages.
And what did the messages tell them?
The messages showed them that it was actually the doctor who was supplying the Burger Bar Boys with all their weapons. In 39 shootings that were conducted throughout the UK, they were all linked back to the doctor for him having purchased or dispersed those firearms to the Burger Bar Boys.
So as a collector, he was selling on?
He had purchased more than 50 antique weapons from licensed dealers between 2009 and 2015 and had been selling them to gang members.
That's a lot of weapons.
More than anyone would reasonably need, I'd say.
So where does this point of the investigation lead? Because he's not supplying bullets.
So the police up until this point have been able to shut down the Burger Bar Boys. They were able to indict and arrest and jail 16 members, totaling something like 200 years in prison. But where were all the bullets coming from, right? Because guns are essentially useless without the bullets. So they had to open up a new investigation called Gold Dust.
Operation Goldust, I assume it's called that because these bullets are pretty evasive.
Right. During the raid on the doctor's house, they find a receipt. The receipt had come from a gun enthusiast in the region as well, in the Birmingham region. And they decided to follow that as a lead to hopefully discover where the bullets might be coming from.
For the police, this receipt from a gun enthusiast was a big breakthrough. Because some gun specialists can legally manufacture bullets for antique guns. So if anybody could help them figure out how such a huge number of unmarked bullets might have found their way into Dr. Sardar's hands, it would be a certified enthusiast, like this guy.
Sorry.
Detectives head to the International Antique and Vintage Arms and Military Affair in Birmingham. And they go to a stand run by Paul Edmonds, the signee of the receipt.
Let's see what we got stuff. We just
lied. The police spoke with Mr. Edmonds for a few minutes outside of the convention center. You know, he's a pensioner. He's got gray hair all around, large chin strap and mustache, soft eyes that sort of hang on his face. He looks like a tired old man. And yeah, the police were ecstatic. They felt like they had found a guy who would teach them what they needed to know. I think earlier we had said that they went into this not knowing much about ammunition or how it's produced and unaware of the community surrounding this sort of bespoke weaponry and bespoke ammunition creation, and were planning on meeting with him in a few days or the next day to show them what they had recovered from other crime scenes in hopes that he could then either describe the process or maybe point to the direction of someone who would know who makes these particular rounds and help them with their investigation that way.
It's June 2015, and the two detectives, Phil Rogers and Greg Taylor, pay Paul Edmonds a visit at his countryside home.
So they come to Mr. Edmonds' house, and he welcomes them in, and he's sort of in this bucolic area in the West Midlands. It's very quiet. It's very rural. And he takes them into his garage, which is his de facto workshop. And it's wall-to-wall ammunition, gun cases, gun safes, antique weapons. There's everything you need to make a piece of ammunition spread across the room. It sort of looks like a hoarder's den. And the all three drink some Cokes, and they sit down to talk about weapons and guns.
And what's he like? What do they make of him?
They think he's a well-faceted man. They think that he knows everything that they have been wanting to learn, and they tap into that knowledge in a sort of a mentor-mentee relationship. But it wasn't until maybe near the end of the conversation that things took a turn. So Rogers and Taylor are standing there, and they're going over again these very, the minutiae of making weapons and bullets in particular, when they pull out another round that they had found at a crime scene, and Paul Edmonds says, yep, that one's mine.
Right. But he points to it and claims it.
Yeah, more or less says, I made that one. That's something that I made. And Taylor recounted for me the story later and told me that he felt that it was strange. He just didn't realize that he was right in the hornet's nest.
The search was over. The ghost bullets were being manufactured in this very workshop. The unlikely criminal mastermind was pensioner Paul Edmonds.
So when you say right in the hornet's nest, what do you mean? What's going through their heads at this point?
So remember, they came into the house thinking that they would sign this man up to be an expert witness and he would help them with the trial of the doctor and the Burger Bar boys. But now they realize that this is the guy who's been supplying the ammunition to the doctor, who in then turn supplied it to the gangs.
So what do they do then? Like, what do you do when you're standing in front of the man who's been supplying ghost bullets?
You say thank you for your time and you leave. They left, and shortly thereafter came back and arrested him.
Paul Edmonds had been collecting guns since he was a child, a keen hobbyist, and for years he had supplied custom-made antique ammunition legitimately to collectors under license.
I know that the police went into his house and tried to take much of his inventory after they had arrested him and failed to do so, if that gives you an idea of sort of how many weapons and how many rounds of ammunition he had just at home, let alone the ones that he was able to sell.
Police found around 100,000 rounds of ammunition in his garage, bedroom, and attic. And detectives have linked 1,000 rounds and 17 guns found at UK crime scenes to Paul Edmonds. And they think many more are still in the hands of criminals. Edmonds took gun buying trips all over the world, around 40 flights in 6 years. Most of the goods were sold on legally to other collectors. But things get pretty messy about the legality of ostensibly selling rounds of ammunition to gangs, however indirectly.
If you directly knock a cup off of a desk, then yes, you did it. But if you hit the table that then knocked over the candle that then rolled over and hit the pen that then accidentally touched the coffee mug that then knocked it off the table, that's a trickier case to prove. His defense in all of this has always been, I didn't directly sell to the Burger Bar boys. I didn't know that the doctor was selling them to the Burger Bar boys. Therefore, I was selling my wares to a registered firearms certificate holder, and I could legally do so. Whatever happens beyond that was not my fault.
A UK court in December 2017 decided that he sold his guns and ghost bullets knowingly to criminals and was therefore guilty of conspiracy to supply firearms and ammunition. Edmonds was sentenced to 30 years in prison, and earlier this year, he lost an appeal against his conviction. He maintains his innocence. A number of amendments to the Offensive Weapons Bill are currently under review. They would impose more restrictions on the ownership and use of antique guns and bullets. Coming up, Catherine Viner on the anniversary of the Peterloo Massacre. Now, in Manchester, 200 years ago today, thousands of people gathered to demand the right to vote. But the gathering was met with violence and spiralled into what became known as the Peterloo Massacre. The scandal and fallout of this crackdown would eventually lead to the very beginning of the Guardian paper. On the anniversary of the massacre, here's our editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner.
The French Revolution, 3 decades before, had spread throughout the world this idea that ordinary people could take on the powerful and win. And that was a revelation for the masses, and it gave a real fright to those in power. The country was mired in an economic depression with high unemployment, and the Corn Laws kept the price of grain artificially high, which meant that many people were starving and couldn't afford to eat. There were sort of frenzies all over the country in all sorts of ways. And there was also a growing campaign for the vote. At the time, the densely populated town of Manchester, it was a town at the time, had no Member of Parliament, whereas a hamlet in the south of England called Old Sarum, which had just one voter living in it, had 2 MPs to represent him. I like this quote from William Hazlitt a year before Peterloo, when he said, "Nothing that was established was to be tolerated. The world was to be turned topsy-turvy." So most of Manchester, in fact, gathered in St Petersfield on 16th of August. The crowd is estimated to be 60,000 people. There were so many of them packed in that an eyewitness at the time said that everyone's hats seemed to be touching. They were coming to listen to the orator. He's a very famous radical speaker called Henry Hunt. The city's magistrates were very intimidated by the number of people who'd come, and intimidated by their demands as well, the demand for the vote. So they ordered armed cavalry to charge the crowd, to break up the meeting, to arrest Henry Hunt. When the troops stormed through the people, they hacked with their sabres. There's a quote from the Times, so they cut everyone they could reach. 11 people were killed on the day. The first victim was a baby pushed out of his mother's arms and stampeded to death. Many hundreds were injured. The event became known as the Peterloo Massacre. Coming so soon after Waterloo, it was seen as a battlefield. The historian A.J.P. Taylor said that Peterloo began the breakup of the old order in England. It took more than 100 years for everyone to get the vote, but it really began with Peterloo. One of the people in the crowd that day was a journalist called John Edward Taylor. When he noticed that a reporter for the Times was arrested, John Edward Taylor was concerned that the people of the capital might not get an accurate report of the massacre. So Taylor rushed a report onto the night coach to London. He got his report into the Times and turned a Manchester demonstration into a national scandal. He became, I think, radicalised by what he'd seen at Peterloo, so horrified that ordinary people peacefully demonstrating should be so attacked. And he decided to set up a newspaper of his own. So Peterloo had happened on the 16th of August 1819, and less than 2 years later, on May the 5th, 1821, the Manchester Guardian was launched, devoted to Enlightenment values, liberty, reform and justice. It was launched with great confidence and optimism by Taylor, who believed that, in spite of Peterloo and police spies, reason is great and would prevail. The manifesto that Taylor produced to launch the paper. He talked about the spirited discussion of political questions that was now taking over the country, that the accurate detail of facts was particularly important at this juncture. He talked about the great diffusion of education, so that many, many more people were becoming educated. So it's a really powerful document, and one whose ideals still shape The Guardian today, 198 years later. It's interesting to me when I read about the launch of The Guardian, because there seem to be so many parallels with the era then with now. There's a quote in the announcement with which John Edward Taylor launched the Manchester Guardian, when he said, "No former period in the history of our country has been marked by the agitation of questions of a more important character than those which are now claiming the attention of the public." When I first read that, that really stopped me up short, because I think, well, that's just the kind of thing we say today. These crucial questions of what technology is doing to society, of what dramatic inequality is doing to communities, of what environmental catastrophe is going to mean for us all. These huge questions, and obviously in Britain, the questions of Brexit also. And here was John Edward Taylor talking about a similar moment. We've lived through different eras, I think, through calmer eras, but there are many parallels with the era we're living through now, with the one that produced both Peterloo and The Guardian.
That was Catherine Viner. My thanks to her and to Kenneth Rosen. And a huge thanks to the whole team here. Don't forget, Today in Focus will be back with you in 2 weeks on Monday the 2nd of September. Today's programme was produced by Dominic Byrne and Gary Marshall. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier and Eloise Stevens. And the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you soon.